I Hate Politics is a podcast about a human activity we love to hate. I'm Marcus Batchelor, sitting in for Sunil Dasgupta. And today we're continuing our mini-series, The Chocolate City Mixtape, talking with George Derek Musgrove. He's a historian, professor, activist, and the co-author of Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. And I'm really excited about this discussion with Professor Musgrove, because not only did we get to dig into a really interesting history of Black activism, Black culture, and Black power in DC from slavery to today, but also put all of that history in context of this current moment. DC is under unprecedented attack, and Black power is under unprecedented attack across the country, and get into talk about the stories that have led to this moment, and then give some lessons to a current generation trying to grapple with this fight was a really special treat. So please dig into the discussion and let me know what you think. George Derek Musgrove, welcome to the Chocolate City Mixtape on I Hate Politics.
Thanks for having me. Great name for the podcast.
I think there's no better person to anchor this conversation about where we've been and give us some insight from your perspective about where we're going. You, in 2017, wrote the book Chocolate City, A History of Race and Democracy in the Nation's Capital. What really inspired you and Chris to dive deeper into this subject as a historical phenomenon in terms of democracy in America?
Yeah, I think our interest in writing the book was pretty parochial. We knew that no one had written a book like that in about 50 years. So the last book that was sort of an overview of race and democracy in the district was Constance McLaughlin Green's Secret City. And it's an amazing book, but it came out, I think, in 1967. So even before the April 1968 uprising that really changed the face of the city. And so we thought the city's history was due for another sort of installment when it came to that. So much had transpired since. The other reason was because the city was, when we started writing the book, which was 2012, it was just changing at breakneck speed. You know, the census numbers had come out the year before. DC, for the first time, had lost its Black majority since 1957. You could go to bookstores and to DC History Center discussions, and people were arguing really strenuously about the future of the city and what these changes meant. So it was an exciting time to be doing DC history, and we thought that we could have a helpful intervention in those conversations.
It also talks very explicitly about the pretty frequent episodes of anti-Black action in the city by a white establishment. And so as we think about like this moment we're in, where folks are once again taken to the streets in opposition to a Congress and a president that is threatening our rights, while this is now making headline news, you know, if you read Chocolate City, this is not a very atypical intervention.
Yeah, no question. There's a consistency when it comes to Congress's and the executives to a similar extent relationship to the city. And it's laid out in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which is Congress has the ultimate authority of, or ultimate jurisdiction over the city. It can dictate some of that to us. It can take it back. It's done all of that in the city's history. But sort of the baseline is that you're going to have members of Congress, the president, reaching into the city and using the city kind of in three different ways that we outline in the book. The first is that it's a stage for American democracy. So it matters to national political figures what happens here in the district. It's also sort of a laboratory for policies that national political figures may want to try out, but they're scared to try them back in their home districts, where voters can actually push back against them or even punish them by getting them out of office. We can't do anything to those folks, at least not directly through the the ballot here in the district. And then the last is it becomes this odd battleground for national interests, where people who want to push one policy option and people who want to push another tend to fight over the city and whether or not they implement their vision for the country here in the district. And again, they focus on it because they have that power, and also because there's just not a lot of sanction for messing with the lives of DC residents, because we don't elect those people who are sitting in Congress.
And your book obviously puts race at the center, both in the sense of how our diversity, how Black people have influenced the culture and the institutions, but also how it has influenced our lack of progress in terms of political empowerment, our lack of full home rule, our lack of enfranchisement.
Well, I mean, first thing that I think to remember is that DC's always had this large Black population relative to other parts of the country. We tend to think of cities as places where Black people live. And for the last 50, 60 years of American history, that's absolutely correct. But if you look at American cities back in the 19th century, very few Black people lived in them. Black folks were really sort of a rural population. But DC, from its inception, when Congress gets here in 1800, has a 20% Black population. And the population really never goes below 20% for the entirety of the city's history. Add on to that, that DC in 1957 is the first major American city with a Black majority. And even today, I think locally, we think of about race in the context of having lost the Black majority in 2011. But the fact of the matter is, if today DC became a state, it would be the Blackest state in the union. Right now, the Blackest state in the union is Mississippi, but it's only got a 27-30% Black population. DC is still in the low 40s for its Black population. So race just matters because there are a lot of Black people here. And then there's the issue of Congress and the outsized power that advocates of slavery and then segregation, and more recently, a revived racism or fascism have in the institution. When you're a racist and you're in Congress and you have a disproportionately Black city that is totally naked before your power, you tend to want to reach into it and fiddle with things there so that you can show the folks back home who did elect you, or a nationwide a racially reactionary constituency that you're cultivating, that, you know, you're going to make sure that these Black folks stay in line. You're going to take care of them. And so what that meant back in the 1800s is that advocates of slavery wanted to make sure that the slave trade was not ended in the District of Columbia. They wanted to make sure they protected the institution in the district, because they saw that any backing off of the institution could potentially make it vulnerable across the rest of the South. Back in the 1950s, segregationists wanted to make sure that they could try and sabotage the effort to desegregate DC schools. There were segregationists on the DC committee in the House of Representatives. They held all these sham hearings where they only talked to local people who didn't want desegregation to happen. All these people gave them testimony that it was horrible. It was absolutely dangerous. And they printed up their report from these hearings and shipped thousands of copies at government expense all across the entirety of the South. So well into the 1970s, you'd have people who had read that stuff back in, you know, 1956 when it came out. They'd be like, DC is a hellhole. It's dangerous. There's no way we're going there because all the Black people. And so you have a group of people in the Congress who typically have an investment in these systems of racial hierarchy, and DC becomes one of their primary targets. And the latest iteration of that is, of course, the president's focus on sending the National Guard into majority Black or disproportionately Black and brown cities, certainly Democratic cities. And he used DC as a petri dish for trying to perfect that approach. He's now moved on to Memphis, Chicago, and Portland, which does not have a large Black population, but he's using the same rhetoric on them anyway.
And we've obviously seen the most extreme form of either Trump's actions in DC or Trump's promises in DC already sort of unfold in our history. If you think about the mobilization of troops or the loss of home rule altogether, an entire century where there was no right local government in the District of Columbia. As someone who's analyzed, again, this long arc of history, has, you know, analyzed the characters who are a part of it, but the powers that be, but also activists. What are your highest hopes in terms of your analysis of history for this moment, but also your biggest fears in terms of what we've seen so far in DC history?
Sure. So I'll start with biggest fears and then I'll end on a higher note with highest hopes.
Yeah.
Biggest fears is the Trump administration's vision for how DC should operate, which is really as a fiefdom of the president. Folks talk about the president as a fascist, and I don't think that's totally wrong. But what he really seems to want is to sort of be a quasi king, or to have a place where his word is just automatically accepted by a larger populace, and that he's not only obeyed, but he's also loved. And he struggles, of course, with the second part in a lot of places where he seeks to be obeyed. And DC is one of the few places where has the most legal possibility for doing that. And of course, it gives him this high profile place where he can execute that vision. And so the president turned his attention from DC since the manufactured emergency that he initiated over the summer has ended. But he'll absolutely turn back to the city. And my fear is just how much damage he can do in the many times that he turns back to the city before his term is up. And considering his predilections, if his term is up. Just to give, you know, a quick idea of how scary that is to me. I mean, there's a whole generation of Black wealth in D.C., but also in Prince George's County that was built through affirmative action programs. And that work of getting Black people into jobs in the military, in the federal bureaucracy, and also into the city government's bureaucracy was hard work. It took civil rights activists, Black power activists. Took multiple campaigns where people like Marion Barry were moved into office and then worked for years in office to make sure they got the numbers up for Black contractors. That took a long time. And the Trump administration came and just began wiping away literally a generation or two of Black progress. I mean, if you look at the numbers for people that were fired by DOGE, it's disproportionately Black women. And they focused on those parts of the bureaucracy where Black folks were able to get a toehold. And that has absolutely impoverished parts of Prince George's County and the district because so many breadwinners have lost their jobs. When he circles back around, if he circles back around, there's sure to be just as much pain along those lines. And so that is quite frightening to me. And that doesn't even get us into the issue of home rule, where, you know, he may ask his enablers in the Republican Party in Congress to erode home rule more than he already has. And he is not constrained by the letter of the law. You could see this when he had the crime emergency this past summer. The Home Rule Act states that the president can ask the mayor and the police chief to report to him. That's sort of the legal way in which you interpret a presidential takeover of MPD. Mm-hmm. What Trump tried to do is actually replace the police commissioner with his own appointee, which is just not in the law, right? And so the danger with Trump is not just the legal authority he has, but he's a line stepper. And so it's also his determination to leverage this authority that he has to do even more than he's legally allowed to do. And we have three more years of this crap. Right. The hope that I have in this moment is that because the president is a line stepper, because the president is doing things that are hurting people, not just his opponents, but his supporters, the hope is that there will be a tremendous backlash, and that backlash will legitimize and create a majority interest in the very things that he opposes, namely DC statehood. The whole reason that we have as much Democratic support for DC statehood today is because of Trump. Prior to 2016, the National Democratic Party was not all in for statehood. But when Trump gets elected in 2016, Democrats go, my God, this is the second time in 16 years that a Republican has won with a minority of the national vote. And they win in the Electoral College. And they look at the Senate and they go, you know, my God, this is the umpteenth time in the last 20, 30 years that Republicans have had a minority of the votes that have been cast for members of the Senate but they control the chamber because they control all these small population states. And so they then said, we want to go get ourselves a Democratic Wyoming, effectively. And all of a sudden, you got national Democratic support almost all in. And so the hope is that that will happen again this time around. And so I am both terrified. Every day I wake up, I worry that Trump has sort of turned back towards the district. But I'm also encouraged by the fact that last time around, folks responded to his irresponsibility, to his authoritarianism, to his abuse of the people of the district by going in for statehood.
There's obviously been times where either local autonomy and democracy has been threatened here in the district or has been outright taken away. Like I said, there are large swaths of DC's history where there wasn't local enfranchisement or even kind of the symbols of democracy that we have today. But obviously, there's always been people who've stood up, who've resisted the tide that was happening, who resisted the interference, who organized either to maintain the democracy they had or to gain it, even if they never knew it. And when local government gets more inhibited, what have we seen folks do and how have they organized to get around it?
That's a great question. This struggle has been going on since 1800 when Congress passed the Organic Act, 1801, pardon me. And so I don't want to focus on all of those different moments because they're so disparate, but I will focus on the 1960s and 1970s, which is, you know, sort of that moment where we gained home rule and then very quickly turned around and tried to get a vote in the House and the Senate. And I'll say what really drove the struggle for home rule and then for the DC Voting Rights Amendment was a mass movement on the ground that created pressure from the grassroots. We had, after 1967, an appointed government that looked like a government. And so Lyndon Johnson wanted to pass home rule legislation in 1965. Martin Luther King actually came to the city and did a march in Lafayette Square, sort of thanking the president for proposing home rule legislation. But then the backlash election of 1966 occurred, and segregationists and conservative Republicans in Congress basically killed any possibility of home rule legislation. And so Johnson, being sort of the clever political tactician and strategist that he was, said, okay, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to reorganize the three commissioners who typically run the city. And I'm going to make those commissioners, who were appointed by me, So it's not elected government, but I'm gonna make them look like a government. And so we'll have a mayor commissioner who ended up being Walter Washington. And then we'll have a whole bunch of other commissioners who are a council. They're all appointed by Johnson, but nonetheless. And that put pressure from above on Congress to create a local government. But it was really that movement from below, particularly the Black Power movement, that pushed the stragglers and the people who were still willing to stand with the segregationists and the conservative Republicans against home rule into the camp of backing home rule. It was the Free DC movement started by Marion Barry and L.D. Pratt. It was the NAACP and Walter Fauntroy and other local organizations, the League of Women Voters, the Voteless League of Women Voters here in D.C., who were all just outraged by this moment when democracy was expanding across the country through the civil rights movement, like through the Voting Rights Act, through the initiation of 18-year-old voting in the early 1970s. And it was not expanding in the district. I mean, we got a school board in 1968, a non-voting delegate in 1971, but we still didn't have a local government. Like, you couldn't just call up the mayor and be like, I need a pothole filled, right? And those people came together and pushed from the bottom on those elites in the council to try and stiffen their backbone and say, you all need to not just do whatever Congress says you should do, but you should actually advocate on our behalf to the Congress, which for a lot of the appointed members of the council and for the appointed mayor was scary because here they were going to be yelling at the very people who appointed right. them on behalf of their constituents. Dangerous stuff, right? But they would rather offend President Nixon or the folks who ran the DC committees than have to walk the streets of the district and have their constituents curse them out. Right. And you know, these are serious constituents like Marion Barry and Julius Hobson. I mean, these folks will curse you out. And then the other thing they did is that Walter Fauntroy, our first non-voting delegate, right? We've been very fortunate in this city's history to have two brilliant organizers as our first two delegates, Walter Fauntroy and then Eleanor Holmes Norton. And Walter Fauntroy took DC residents down to South Carolina because the one person who was standing in between the city and home rule was a guy named John McMillan from South Carolina. He was the head of the DC committee in the House. And every year from the 50s forward, the Senate would pass home rule legislation. And then John McMillan would work with his little buddies in the DC committee in the House and he'd kill it. And so they said, fine, we're going to get rid of John McMillan. So DC residents head down to South Carolina, organize black voters in his district, and they defeated him in the election of 1972. And when that happened, Charlie Diggs, who's a good friend of the city and a good friend of Walter Fauntroy's, became the chair of the DC committee in the House. And one of the first things he did is put home rule legislation on the calendar, and it passes about a year later. So it's that movement at the grassroots pushing local appointed officials to advocate on the city's behalf, pushing our friends in Congress to keep up the pressure to get what we need, and pushing to defeat our enemies in Congress who were going to stand in the way of home rule. So it was all three of those things, but coming from the people of the district, using every lever of power that they could find to make sure that we got our rights as American citizens. And they got some of them, but the job was never done. And all those people that secured home rule for us essentially said, one, the law that we have passed is not good enough because Congress can still interfere in our affairs as American citizens. And two, we need representation in Congress because to not have so is un-American. And so that fight continues. We are very fortunate that we have that rich legacy to draw on and to inspire us. But then we need to do right by that legacy and show up and show out in the here and now to secure our full rights as American citizens today.
Yeah. And I think a perfect segue into how we do that. I just thought about the road always gets harder in conservative or Republican administrations for DC, whether it's the level of interference or it's our eventual path to full self-determination, our path to statehood. And one of your latest projects is about the Black Power resurgence in conservative America. And it looks like you analyze a time period between 1980 and 97, which is the Republican Revolution, right? The Reagan years into Newt Gingrich's Contract with America. It feels like we're in that moment again, where it's cool to be conservative again. We've lost the political high ground in terms of popular appeal, but it also means that our situation in the district is bound to get worse. As you're thinking about Democratic cities, DC in particular, but also other cities around the country that are led by Black mayors, Chicago, Oakland, New York City, Memphis. What did working on this project, I guess, did it bring up any resonance in terms of what we're going through today?
So yeah, my current book project, which is called To the Streets Again, the Black Power Resurgence in Conservative America, was really rooted in a lot of experiences I had in DC as a 10-year-old. You know, 12-year-old. I can remember coming to the Free South Africa movement protests here in 1985. I can remember listening to Sweet Honey in the Rock singing about Free South Africa. I can remember Marion Barry making sure that African Americans got their piece of the pie after centuries of not getting the same rights and resources as their white fellow residents. And I can remember, you know, the city government itself being positively crucial to the Black Family Reunion, which the National Council of Negro Women staged here in the district in 1986, and to the Million Man March. I mean, you know, without the city government really working with the Nation of Islam and its partner organizations, Million Man March doesn't really come off in the district. And the lesson I'm taking for today is that we can look to a lot of Black elected officials to push back against the Trump administration. And we should. If you're a Black elected official, you're from a majority Black constituency, and the current occupant of the White House is shaping much of his political program around attacking Black and brown people, then you would expect your chosen leadership to stand up for their constituents. But what I also know from my studies of the 1980s and 1990s, and keep in mind that Trump models a lot of his pitch and the personnel that he's using to people his government on the Reagan administration. And what the Black elected officials, who were much smaller in number in the 1980s and early 1990s, had that we don't have to the same degree today, is a very robust, skilled, and mobilized Black civil society backing them up. Jesse Jackson could run for office because there was a very large progressive Black church community that was willing to buoy his campaign. The NAACP was doing huge voter registration drives. We don't have that same robust infrastructure that we did then. And so a lot of our Black elected officials don't have this grassroots push to have them stiffen their backbone to stand up to fascism today. But that's the beauty. There's an opportunity here. We can flood into local organizations. We can rejoin organizations that our parents might have walked away from and create that push to get those Black elected officials, to get Democratic elected officials, heck, to get Republican elected officials who love democracy to do what they're supposed to be doing. And so for all of your listeners, please go back and join the NAACP. For DC residents, join Free DC, which is leading the fight against all of these violations of home rule. Contribute to DC Vote, where I'm a proud member of the board, and we're lobbying on Capitol Hill to try and get Democrats to stick together to support home rule, and those Republicans who can be convinced to back us on this as well. You know, there is an argument to be made for democracy in these very unfortunate times, and we have to push our elected officials to make that argument. It's the right thing to do. It's also what they owe us as their constituents. But sometimes folks need a little nudge to do the right.
Absolutely. A perfect synopsis of the moment we're in and a perfect call to action for our listeners. Tap back in, get involved, find community, find organizations where you're willing to lend whatever time or treasure or talent that you have. It's important to lean into those communities now more than ever. I try to end every conversation on something fun. So want to roll into that before we close out. But is there anything else that you want to say to listeners or tell us ways that we can tap into the work you're doing?
You know, it, as a historian, it feels a little silly to be pitching my work when we all need to be out on the streets manning the barricades. I will say that if you're seeking inspiration for how to get out there in the streets and how to sort of be inventive about pushing back about against what's happening to the city now, my website, blackpowerindc.umbc.edu, is a good inspiration for activists. The other thing I'll just say is that what we cannot do is make this easy for the folks who are trying to degrade American democracy in our very lives. DC is not in a great position to push back against the Trump administration, but we have to try. And we already know that these folks don't have our best interests at heart. And so to all the folks in Adams Morgan who are screaming out La Migra when ICE comes into the neighborhood, God bless you. For folks at Free DC who are trooping down to the Hill every single day, making sure that members of Congress know that we don't like what is happening to our city, God bless you. And I hope that more people will get out into the streets to help them. Because when it comes right down to it, we don't have the law on our side necessarily, but we do have each other. And so we need to make sure we're looking out for one another and each other's rights.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Let's get to what I call my guest mixtape. So I want to end with just five rapid response questions that I ask every guest at the end of the podcast. Favorite DC restaurant, past or present?
Oh, man. I guess I'll go with Habaneros, which is a taco spot on 14th Street.
We love tacos. I'm going to add that to my list.
I must add this. If we're just talking about volume, probably Tropicana, which is no longer open. Yep. It was a great chicken spot.
I remember Tropicana. I missed that one. But all right, favorite go-go band.
So this is where I'm showing my Baltimore background, right? You know, I've always loved go-go, but I've never been a go-go head.
Sure.
And so my favorite go-go song and behind it, my favorite go-go band is Moody's Mood for Love by Chuck Brown. But that's weird because it's a, you know, it's a jazz standard that Chuck sort of redid, but it's funky as hell.
Hey, playing your game, Chuck Brown version is far better than the Barry White version. So
yeah,
no, that still counts. All right. DC location that still feels like DC.
Sankofa. Sankofa Cafe right across from Howard University. I've been going there to write every week for well over a decade and a half.
Oh,
and I
mean,
it opened in the 90s, so, you know, it's takes me back.
A DC native, living or dead, that inspires you.
The funny thing about this is so many of my heroes that I think people think are DC natives are not.
Right.
Frederick Douglass to Mary Church Terrell to Julius Hobson to Marion Barry. I mean, they're all born somewhere else. I mean, shoot, Chuck Brown was born in Virginia, right? Yeah,
see, maybe I made this question trickier than I thought.
Yeah. Oh, so I will say this. Edward Brooke, a lot of people forget that he's a DC native. Edward Brooke, who's, of course, the first African-American to serve in the Senate in the 20th century from Massachusetts. But he was born here in the district, raised here in the district. And the reason he's a real hero to me, and I think it's appropriate for this conversation, is because even though this really didn't gain him a lot of votes at home, he was one of the most active advocates for a vote in Congress for the district in the entire Congress, House or Senate. And that was because he loved his hometown. He loved the people. And he thought that the way that Congress had treated the district was wrong. And so definitely Edward Brooke.
Yeah, I like that one. And the last one, and I think you packed a lot into your call to action, but one thing the listener listening right now can do to save Chocolate City.
Join with your fellow residents in an organization to advocate for the city. Make sure you're registered to vote. Go out and vote for people who are running for council or mayor or non-voting delegate who will stand up for the city. Whatever you do, get out there, join an organization. Make sure you're working with other people to advocate for this place and the people.
Incredible. No better way to end there. So we'll leave it there. Professor Musgrove, thank you so much for coming on the Chocolate City Mixtape on I Hate Politics.
Glad to do it. Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode of the Chocolate City Mixtape on the I Hate Politics podcast. Be sure to tune in on Tuesday mornings for our news analysis. The I Hate Politics podcast is produced by Sunil Dasgupta with the support of University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Chocolate City Mixtape is hosted and co-produced by me, Marcus Batchelor. Make sure to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts for politics close to you and your home. Thanks.